You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello, welcome, and ho 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 from us here at A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. I'm Matt, and I'm once again joined by my friend Julie. Hey, Julie.
Hi.
And it is basically Christmas, so as we've done over the last couple of years, we are going to regale you with some festive cheer with this Christmas special episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. We've decided this year to look at the kind of things that we would like to find under our Christmas trees, whether that's actual real things, you know, I absolutely want that Stormtrooper action figure, or I totally want that Antonioni box set, who knows? Or it could also be more kind of idealistic things, more fantastic things, even surreal things. If someone wants a T-Rex under their Christmas tree, I think, you know, go for it. If not in 2021, when can you do this kind of thing? So we're joined, not directly, but we're joined by little parcels of MP3s and WAV files by some of our regular contributors here. And we are going to start with Magga.
Hello, this is Magga. This is part of the Christmas special 2021. I'm really not a huge comic fan. I'm really picky when it comes to comics. Also not really into sci-fi. And it's a surprise to myself that I really like Saga. It's a comic and it's sort of sci-fi. It's by Brian K. Vaughan, the writer, and Fiona Staples, the artist. It's a rather long-running series. The first volume was released in October 2012. It's available until volume 9, released in October 2018. That was well before Corona, and Vaughan and Staples announced that they would take a break in publishing the comic, but would continue, and they left us with one hell of a cliffhanger. I remember that my daughter was heartbroken when she came to the end of Volume 9. The good news is, Volume 10, rumor has it, will be published in early 2022. That's not official yet, but there are definite rumors that the series will continue next year. It's some kind of, at its core, some kind of Romeo and Juliet story. There are two warring parties from two different planets, and when I say planet, one of them is a moon. There are people with horns, there are people with wings, and they are at war with each other. They bring their war to other planets, other places. There are veterans, there is magic involved, and one woman with wings and one guy with horns have a meet cute, fall in love with each other, and there's a child with horns and wings, the first of its kind. And I really, really want to know where it's going. The somewhat generic title, Saga, is a problem because if you Google that, you always end up with the band or something else containing the word Saga. That's it. I hope you have a merry, merry Christmas and see you next year. Stay tuned. Bye-bye.
That's it from Magga. Thank you very much to him. Magga, of course, being one of the two founders of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture, and it's great to have him back here for the Christmas special. Julie, have you read Saga yourself?
Yes, I've read, well, as Magga said, I've read part of it because it's not finished. And I think, Matt, that you were the one who got me into Saga in the first place, because I think you pointed it out to me when I was choosing comics, or rather graphic novels, in Antwerp. I made a poll and I asked, which one should I get? And I think you won the poll by having me get Saga, the entire thing. And even though Magga says his daughter's read it, this is adult stuff for our listeners. This is not for children. This is a graphic novel with adult content. So use judgment, and certainly not for small children, but older children might be able to appreciate it. I just want to warn you out there that it's, especially the beginning, it's content heavy, let's say.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of those comics that I think story-wise and in terms of the characters, I could absolutely imagine teenagers absolutely loving this.
Certainly.
But the thing is, you've got lots of, you know, cute animals, you've got fun characters, and then suddenly you've got really graphic violence. And more surprisingly for me, extremely graphic sex, which in an American comic is very, very rare. I think it absolutely pulls it off. It works for the comic. But yeah, even I was quite surprised when I kind of turned the page and suddenly, okay. What about you, Julie? What would you like to find in a parcel under the tree?
Well, it's been a year of books, it seems. I mean, Mag has already chosen this epic graphic novel. And for me, it's audiobooks. I think regular listeners of the shows know that I'm an audiobook lover. It's also a matter of access. It's easier for some people to listen to audiobooks than to read an actual book. And so, well, there are a couple of books that I really would like to see in audio that are not currently in audio. And I know it's a stretch and it's a big ask, but Miss Olympia Kyriakou has written like this big book about Carol Lombard. It's called Becoming Carol Lombard. And I want to be able to have access to this book so much that I actually wrote the publisher and asked them, is there any chance at all that this might be available in audio at some point? And then, of course, there's Christina Rice, who wrote a book that I really want to get a hold of about Jane Russell, another one about Anne Dvorak. And those are also not available on audio. So in terms of access, I mean, I really would love to have more access to books like these. I know it's very niche, and I know I'm very fortunate because I live in an age where I have a couple of subscriptions. I have access to almost everything. I can have content coming out of my ears if I like. But these types of books, I think, sort of deserve a wider public and a wider readership. And then there's this sort of more shallow little ask that is a nice to have that I've been brooding on for a long time now. I'm a Terry Pratchett fan as well. People might have sort of guessed at that. And there's just come a new audiobook of Hogfather, Terry Pratchett's Hogfather, which is one of a series in the Discworld universe. And it's a new recording. Bill Nighy's doing the notes. A lot of fun. And it makes me think that the earlier recordings, which are done by Nigel Planer, read by Nigel Planer, the audio quality on those is so poor that I wish that they would do the whole series as a kind of special edition. I mean, do them with Stephen Briggs, do them with Zoe Wanamaker, do them with somebody fabulous. I really don't mind who, but I would love to have them in like pristine, crystal clear audio quality and not the sort of very grungy recording that we have now, however lovely Nigel Planer is. So that is what I would very much like on The Christmas Tree. I know it's not a very sort of moral or fundamental or philosophical ask, but as I'm pretty dependent on these audiobooks, I would love always like to have more of them.
I think you might actually be lucky. I'm not entirely certain, but I thought that they announced some new Terry Pratchett audiobooks with the likes of Bill Nighy and Peter Serafinowicz, but I don't know whether they're going to cover all of those specific books as well.
As much as I know, I think they're going to do Rincewind, and they've released Hogfather for Christmas, which is a completely new reading with, you're exactly right, Bill Nighy, which of course I already have because I could not wait.
Absolutely. Okay, do you think this is a good moment for us to kind of lead on to our second surprise parcel of the evening?
Yes, someone who I have spoken to not too long ago. Take it away.
Hello and happy holidays. This is Daniel Thron. I'm proud to be asked back on Damn Fine Cup to talk about what I would like to see under the tree this holiday season. I was told there could be anything from physical media to abstract concepts. So I'll get the physical media part out of the way right away. And for anyone in my family who's listening, that would be the Criterion Blu-ray edition of Miller's Crossing, which is coming out shortly and looks incredible. But for the abstract answer, and the one that's more important to me, it comes from reading an article in one of the trades recently that suggested, now that it's so easy to identify niches and markets via streaming and metadata, that maybe the future of film distribution might be in putting out different edits of movies upon their release so that they play better for whatever given political or social bubble the audience happens to live in, like toned down gay relationships or edited out political statements, etc., so that audiences don't get their feathers ruffled and studios can still guarantee themselves a big payday. I think this is a terrible idea, and the last thing we need, especially in my home country, is further media reinforcement of us-them thinking. What I'd like to see under the tree this year is this. I'd like for everyone, myself included, to try to practice a little more empathy. And I don't just mean like the flowers and unicorns, nice, happy kind. I mean, the hard kind where we really challenge ourselves to see things from other perspectives. And the easiest and best way to do this, for my money, is watching movies. Movies are empathy machines. More than almost any other art form, they allow us to see the world through different lenses. And it doesn't just give us an understanding of other people. It gives us a chance to better understand ourselves. So even when it seems like there's insurmountable differences, we can still see each other as human through common feelings of friendship and pain and fear and hope and love. Because once you see someone is in pain, you want to heal them. Once you see that someone is afraid, you want to help them not be afraid. Once you see that someone loves someone else, you can't unsee it. You know what love is. It changes how you feel, and it destroys preconceptions. I think this is one of the most important things we can be doing right now, because the world's been through some tough times for the past couple of years, and we've wanted to watch things that comfort us. And that's totally understandable. That's, in fact, what we talked about last time I did this. But I think that we're in danger of cementing our own bubbles. And that's a sadness when there's so much available to us now, and their platforms offer so many different kinds of experiences and movies from other countries and other points of view all over the place. Yet we often just continue to choose the things that make us feel better for believing what we already believe. I think we have to try to take a step out of that. It's our responsibility to search things out that challenge us and to resist the urge to watch stuff that caters to our preconceptions. And instead of that, like, pick stuff that makes us think, things that open our hearts and open our minds, so that for holiday seasons to come, our world is better and more inclusive and more filled with love. Or, you know, if nothing else, then at least we get some better movies. But anyway, happy holidays to everyone out there. And I hope that this coming year is a healing one for everyone. And when we next talk, it's just going to be about Dune 2. That's next Christmas's Under the Tree ask. Thanks.
Yeah. I do hope he joins us for Dune 2 as well. We had a lovely, lovely conversation about a lovely film.
Totally. With a lovely guy. With lovely guys, actually.
Yes. Both of them are enormous, enormous nerds on sci-fi, if you haven't figured that one out yet.
Absolutely. I mean, aren't we all really?
Well, then again, yeah, exactly. So am I, in my own sort of way. I didn't know about that. I know about filter bubbles and so on, of course, but I didn't know that there was actually an idea to ensconce us even more in our own little filter bubbles. That seems like a terrible idea to me. It seems like the antithesis of movies and books and fantasy and literature and sci-fi and all of that stuff, to say, okay, look, we need to tone down stuff that might make audiences, specific audiences, uncomfortable. I mean, the idea of going back to the 50s, but doing it for specific groups, I thought we were trying to escape from that. And I think it's antithetical to literature. It's antithetical to movies. It's antithetical to everything, all fiction and nonfiction that we love.
It's a tough one, because I also think that, you know, if there is culture that challenges us, that's absolutely good. That's important. I think we should be challenged by differences, different ideas, different cultures, different opinions. But I also think it is important to be critical of the culture that we see. So I think I absolutely see that you should be able to criticize something if it's reactionary, if it's basically about putting down certain groups of people for being who they are, not for their ideas so much as for, you know, their identities. But it is a very tricky balance. And I definitely agree with Dan that we're not going to get out of this by customizing everything so that we hear is only what basically we, you know, art should be a mirror to all of us. It shouldn't be a mirror to each of us individually and just show us ourselves and our own faces, because let's face it, that would also be really, really boring.
Yeah. And also, let's not lie to ourselves. If you like classic movies, and I do, count the amount of times that women are slapped around very nonchalantly, as if it's the most normal thing in the world. If a woman is being problematic, you slap her around. It doesn't mean that I hate these movies, but that is a trope that we are trying to get away from, and the sort of gay people do not exist and non-binary people do not exist and gender is not a spectrum type ideas. It's something we're trying to get away from, not gallop towards at, you know, breaking the sound barrier. So I think we should broaden our horizons and not ensconce ourselves into a bubble that we're already in. Because as you say, it's just at its best, it's just not very interesting.
And we should definitely not be paying companies to provide us with those bubbles that we're already in. But talking about paying companies for stuff that we want to see or hear, I think the parcel that I would like to find under my Christmas tree is a very big Criterion box set of the films of Akira Kurosawa. I mean, as readers of our website will know, I've been on a basically journey through the works of Ingmar Bergman. Criterion issued a huge, wonderful, fantastic box set of his movies a couple of years ago, and we've now been watching them for a couple of years, about one of those films a month. It's amazingly rich. It's amazingly also varied. You wouldn't think that. Obviously, there are themes and techniques and definitely actors that keep coming back. I mean, Max von Sydow has been a very, very frequent guest in our living room, which I'm perfectly okay with, obviously. But I would like to see the same for a director like Kurosawa, who worked for decades, whose works have been very varied. I mean, obviously, if you don't really know Kurosawa, you think of, samurais and more samurais, which is fine. But there's so much more there. There's crime drama. There's Shakespeare adaptations. There's domestic dramas. There's very different styles, very different also feels and tones. And with the Bergman box set, I found that just watching an artist's work in the context of everything that they've done enriches your experience of these works. And Kurosawa, of course, is a very rich and very enjoyable director. I would love to see something like that. It's not like I'm, you know, I've got more than enough things to watch already. We've got the Fellini box set. We've got the Agnes Varda box set. But I would love to complete that with a Kurosawa box set. And at that point, I could probably say, I don't need to buy any more DVDs, any more Blu-rays, because I'm set for life, literally.
You can always watch more Kurosawa, I think.
Absolutely.
Because my favorite Kurosawa also changes once every so many years. I stick with this one favorite film of his that then stays with me for a couple of years. And then I rewatch another one and I'm like, this is brilliant. And then that becomes my new favorite. It's just incredible, incredible stuff.
Exactly. So hear this, Criterion. I know that you're listening to us.
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's time for our third little surprise parcel under the tree. He forgot to mention his name at the beginning, so let's perhaps do this here. This is from our regular contributor, Alan, one of our regular baristas here at the Damn Fine Cup of Culture, and this is his wish for Christmas.
I think the first ideal cultural present I'd like to open underneath this fantasy Christmas tree would be an early screening of Dune 2, somehow transported back in time from them having finished making it. And then followed by possibly Dune 3, Dune 4, with all these sequels pretty much starting to ignore the books and going their own way with new writers taking the universe in another direction. I'd also, if we've got more space under the tree for even more universes, wouldn't mind more epic science fiction films and not just trying to adapt 50s and 60s classic, but approaching new writers to tell new stories, but on that scale. It's great that cinema now has the technology to realise that, and it would be perfect to get modern writers to take advantage of it, rather than necessarily going back and making epic adventures that are still basically, in some ways, stuck in the 50s. Also under the tree, and I appreciate it's getting quite packed, I wouldn't mind a few TV shows. First of all, if we're looking at long-running TV series that I could watch one episode a week to help spread out time if we're heading into another lockdown. The first of these would be a long-running adaptation of Walter Mosley's Easy Rawlins books, which I think are just begging for an adaptation. And especially covering so many books now and really running with the fact that in the books, The stories continue from book to book. Each one is individually a detective story, but there is such a long arcing tale for the lead character that really covers sort of changing America. It would seem perfect for Netflix or another streaming service. The other thing I wouldn't mind is if, going back to science fiction, maybe a long-running TV series based on Becky Chambers' Wayfarer series. Again, we've got the technology for this now, and it would be nice to see that happen. But if we're getting the ultimate idealized fantasy cultural Christmas present that is beyond impossible to really hope for, but somehow magically appears under the tree, then I would definitely go for a second series of the 1969 ITC drama series Randall and Hopkirk Deceased. It would have to be made in 1970, so we would have to be involving time travel again. Go back, get the principal characters, and make another series. It's definitely one of my favourite escapist TV shows just to watch when I want to unwind, and the fact there was only ever one series is always a huge shame. I especially can help in this because as a teenager, I actually plotted out the second season. So every single episode had a summary written. I even was trying to imagine what guest stars would appear in a 70s ITC serial. So all that work has already been done. I just need the time travel machine to go back, be a showrunner in 1970, and then bring it forward to place it underneath this fantasy Christmas tree. I hope that's not too demanding, and I hope you all have a very Merry Christmas.
Alan wants a TARDIS.
Absolutely. I think time machines are involved in a lot of these wishes, if we're honest about it. But, I mean, let's face it, if they did a time machine nowadays, it would probably involve Bitcoin and NFTs and
blockchain. I think Alan makes a really valid point that we've all sort of been ruminating about, is that now we also have the new Robert Jordan series, which is sounds fabulous, but I've always had deep criticisms of the books, and the same thing goes for the Dune series, and the same thing goes for a lot of these things that are fantastic in themselves, but have been written, as Alan rightly points out, a long time ago. And we do have these fantastic new series by new writers that are sort of being overlooked. I mean, I love Dune, but there's something to be said about saying, okay, we're doing that again. Whereas there's this entire pool of stories that have never really been tapped. And as we go again into lockdown again, I think it's like a super opportunity to pick some of those up. I mean, the Wayfarer series sounds absolutely scrumptious. I mean, I would love that. I would pay for that. Definitely. What do you think?
I think I'm not as down on adapting older material, because I also think that, you know, if you take older material, you always reflect it through the times that are adapting it. I mean, I come from literature in some ways more than film, originally at least, and I always have time for a great new Shakespeare adaptation, because obviously a Shakespeare adaptation in 2022 is going to be different from Shakespeare adaptation in 1940 or 1950, which doesn't mean that I don't also agree that we should obviously do stuff that's new, pick up, you know, material that is newer and that is in a way reflects these times. We should not always just be looking back. We should also not always just be, you know, doing new installments in franchises that are 40 years old. Even though the money is there, the fans are there, the fans are clamoring for their next fix of nostalgia, but it shouldn't all just be nostalgia. And I think especially if it is something that is an adaptation of an old franchise, for instance, or an old IP, or just an old book, it should not appeal to nostalgia. It should make these things fresh and new and current. Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah, and there's also, of course, the matter of representation. I've touched on this a little bit earlier, is that it's very limited in some of these works, which is inevitable. I don't blame them for being limited. I mean, Elizabethan age was limited, and we don't throw away Shakespeare. But I think in these new, you have to work around these problems with representation. You see that with Dune, and I'm hoping and supposing that we see that with Robert Jordan as well. And I think newer material gives more room for more diversity. And I'm really, really looking for that, especially in a sci-fi and a fantasy universe. which is very hobbity. I mean, like, as Terry Pratchett once said, I think Tolkien is like Mount Fukushima in Japan. All the prints that you see either don't have it on purpose or have it large or have it small, but it's always there in your mind. And I think younger writers and newer writers may have sort of a more diverse pair of glasses to watch those same old mountains through. And I would be excited to see that.
Absolutely. I have to admit that even though my parcel under the tree was the Criterion collection box set of Kurosawa, there's another parcel that, if I really had my wish, it would not be the Criterion box set. I want that, but what I want more, especially since we've just had Alan talking, friends from the UK, Alan and his girlfriend, who haven't been able to come over for a long, long time now because of COVID. And I think I want that for Christmas. I want to be able to sit together with friends I haven't seen in a long time, other than on Zoom, on Google Meet, sit down with them, have some good food, watch some good movies, play some good board games, just laugh and be silly and just be together again. And I think that's something that I'm wishing for all of us and for all of our listeners, that probably there's lots of people that we haven't been able to see, or we haven't been able to see them normally under normal circumstances. It's always been overshadowed by this stupid little virus and its brethren, and I'm just fed up with them. I do hope that in 2022, we'll all find some kind of normalcy again when it comes to, you know, spending time with the people that we like most. And culture obviously comes into it. Damn fine cups of culture should always be there. But in a way, they're just an occasion for us to enjoy the company of others. So yeah, the parcel that I really want under the tree, sorry Criterion, don't listen to this, is for our friends to be able to come over and spend Christmas with us.
Yeah, we want to be able to enjoy together in a more, I think, in a more physical proximity. I don't know if our listeners realize this, but I'm in the Netherlands, you're in Switzerland, Alan is in the UK, and we do all this stuff online. But sometimes, as Matt says, it would be nice to actually have an actual cup of actual Swiss coffee in actual Switzerland.
Well, the coffee doesn't have to be Swiss, but there can be Swiss chocolate with it.
Yes.
But talking of Switzerland, we've got another Swiss addition to our Christmas parcels, namely Sam.
Hey, listeners. Despite 2021's difficult sides, an ongoing pandemic, and the ongoing frustrations, crises, and bad news attached to this, I came into the new year positive, if a little nervous, about the return of my favorite movie hero, James Bond. After all, his newest adventure, No Time to Die, had been the first victim of last year's lockdown and had been postponed at least 3 times since. Finally, at the end of September, I sat at a Zurich cinema with my best Bond friend and was both prepared and unprepared. Prepared for the actual screening of the film, of course, but completely unprepared and unspoiled for what was to come. I feel safe now, by the way, to do without spoiler disclaimers and shout it off the rooftops of the world. Bond came, he saw, and, well, died. So there I sat at the end of an almost 3-hour thrill ride and did not quite know what to make of this. Had they unjustly killed my screen icon? Someone whose legacy I had followed for the largest part of my life? Or had I just witnessed a daring spectacle of a move by the Bond creators towards an uncertain but exciting future? It didn't take long before the internet was abuzz with both praise and criticism. Wonderful film, except the ending. Abomination of a Bond film by people who clearly didn't know what they were doing. And it took me a while and 4 more screenings to come to my senses and calibrate my Bondian taste buds. And now, at the end of the year, I feel safe to say, for me, they've created one of the best Bond films in memory. Not just the beautifully shot and poignantly emotional coda of Daniel Craig's tenure as Bond, with a finale that seemed to shake, not stir, Bond and Craig into one, and bidding at least one of them farewell. No Time to Die also turned out to be one of the most thoughtfully written, clearly judged, suspenseful and exciting film in memory. For one of the first times, I felt there was truly something at stake. Bond's future, his potential happiness as a father and partner, him being able to return home, a word as relevant to the film as having all the time in the world. Of course, Cary Fukunaga's direction also made sure the action had punch and gut, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge's dialogues clearly sizzled and amused. But there was also something that I had rarely experienced in a Bond film. This actually had themes running through it. Literal and metaphorical families, for example. The fickleness of having time. The intangible nature of enemies and friends, among others. It used foreshadowing, Leiter's death as a preview of Bond's juxtaposition, Safin as a perverted version of Bond himself, and it truly called back on a range of characters that actually felt like they were cut from life, fleshed out. Q intended to host a boyfriend. M had a drinking and secrecy problem. Felix Leiter was eager to get home to his family, and arch-villain Blofeld took revenge on Bond for his own loneliness. Yet there was also irreverent fun, grand displays of pure Bondian escapism, for instance in a much-beloved Cuba scene with Ana de Armas, but also action that meant something, like the equally adorable Matera opening, with a beautiful homage to Bond's lost love, Vesper Lindt. First and foremost, however, despite its flaws, a rather low-key villain in Rami Malek, and a lackluster villain's lair on the overused secret island, No Time to Die took great risks and dared to be bold. Bond had a daughter, Mathilde, and none of it was embarrassing or in bad taste. Bond fell deeply in love, and thanks to Daniel Craig's talents, none of it felt stiff. And his love interest was front and center of the movie. This maybe most of all keeps stunning me. Madeleine Swann's story, her childhood trauma and her decisions ever since were the dramatic hook of the entire film. And she is left behind, grief-stricken, when Bond is pulverized by dozens of missiles on Safin's Island. Their last phone call conversation is gut-wrenching and must have jerked not few tears from an equally stunned audience. It felt poignant and real, reminiscent of so many last calls people must have experienced who lost loved ones in the field. When the missiles rain down on Bond, however, he dies happily. Madeleine has just confirmed to him that, yes indeed, Mathilde is, in fact, his daughter. The missiles explode and look like fireworks for a moment. We're celebrating Bond's legacy as a father, as a hero taken away from us in a battle, and as a hero of an astounding 25 films. But we're also celebrating the end of Craig as Bond, who had to fight his way up into the appreciation of Bond fans. James Bond will return, the credits claim. And I remained in my seat, moved and happy. They've given me back Bond, and taken him away from me again within 3 hours. At least this Bond, and at least for a little while. And with it, they've created something incredibly relevant and beautiful for me. Something that surely counted in 2021. We didn't deserve anything less. So Merry Christmas to you, Mr. Bond, wherever you are.
Wow.
I think all fans should be like Sam, you know, none of that kind of toxic sense of entitlement, but just a sense of wonder and love for the material wherever it takes you. I think that is very, very rare.
It is.
And quite sweet.
And Sam's not just a fan, he's an expert on all things Bond.
But not one of those, well, actually experts, but one who isn't there to prove that he knows everything better, but one who's there to enjoy what he talks about. And it's weird. I mean, in some ways, this is almost less of a Christmassy note to end on than an Easter one. It's all about, you know, death, resurrection, and all of that via James Bond. I don't want to become religious here, but I think let's hope that, you know, when 2021 ends and 2022 comes, that there is hope for something new and better there, because we all want it, we need it, and I think we deserve it.
Yeah, and I want to especially appreciate all our contributors over last year. Thank you all so much for joining us on the podcast. It's been a blast having you and such a blessing, really.
Absolutely. It's been a fun year. It's been an exciting year when it comes to A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. And in that respect, I am definitely looking forward to 2022, hopefully with fewer postponements, with less of a lockdown feel to it, but just with lots of damn fine cups of culture. And for the next couple of weeks, perhaps also a couple of damn fine cups of eggnog. So, obviously, many thanks to you, Julie, and to all our baristas, Alan, Eric, Maga, and Sam. And thank you to our guests, especially Dan and his wonderful contribution to this Christmas special. And once again, thanks to all our listeners. Wishing all of you a happy holiday, and see you next year.
Take care.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.